K-Mud Podcast presents.
Good evening and welcome to the show. This is Global Stuff. My name is Jimmy Derschlag, the fourth Friday of the month, and sometimes we're pre-recorded, sometimes we're live. This time we're live in the studio, and we'll have our guest live, I hope. Do we have him yet? We've got him. Great. And we'll be taking your calls later in the show. Usually in the second half, we take calls from folks, and I'm very pleased to welcome back for this post-Christmas, pre-New Year's show, guest who's been on pretty regularly, a friend of the show, I'd say. That's Stephen Zunis. He's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. He was the founding director there of the program in Middle Eastern Studies, and he's recognized as one of the country's leading scholars of U.S. Middle East policy, strategic nonviolent action. Welcome to the show, Stephen. Are you there? Do we have
you? Great to be with you again, Jimmy.
Yeah, great. I'm glad you could make the time in this holiday season. Hope you're having happy holidays anyway. I keep getting
low key, but pleasant.
I've been getting all Alexa telling me that there's big surf advisories in San Francisco, so you must have some high tides crashing there, I guess.
Well, I actually live down in Santa Cruz, and we lost a chunk of our wharf a few days ago.
I heard that.
And damage in the Yacht Harbor, and a lot of driftwood and pieces of the wharf on area beaches. So it's been pretty exciting here.
Yeah, very crazy.
Really sorry about the damage, though there is that little kid in me who thinks it's really cool to see these giant waves smashing against the rocks and spraying and everything.
Yeah, the Santa Cruz waterfront has been real challenged. I know I have some friends that I visited there, and they've been trying to repair that for a while. So now they've got to go at it again, I guess. So anyway, the impetus behind bringing you on, although we love to bring you on periodically, a recent article that was posted, an interview you did with Counterpunch about the ousting of the Assad regime. And that's certainly something that you've followed regularly in your writings and studies of Syria and the Middle East. And that's certainly a topic that's been in the news a lot. And that's just a very dramatic action that just happened with the rebels, the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, also known as HTS, recently taking over a dramatic part of the country, and Bashar al-Assad, the person who's been in charge there since 2000, gone from the country. Maybe you can give the listeners who aren't necessarily familiar with that whole process of what happened with all those recent events, at least a summary of it.
Well, the dynastic dictatorship of the Assad family, which has ruled Syria for 54 years, was toppled, was overthrown, that Bashar Assad fled to Russia, which had been one of his major benefactors, supporters. He was the last of the military-based secular nationalist regimes that had at one time, you know, play a prominent role in the Middle East, though some of them, and initially Syria, did bring, you know, some redistribution of wealth, some socialist initiatives, and strong nationalist efforts against Western imperialism and the like. Like a number of these regimes, you know, such as the Saddam Hussein's government in Iraq, it slid into increasingly repressive authoritarianism. The The only way that the younger Assad liberalized from his father was economically. So what had been a semi-socialist, if authoritarian state evolved more into a kind of crony capitalist state where inequality and corruption was along with the worsening repression led to a point where there was a initially nonviolent pro-democracy uprising in 2011, about the same time of similar uprisings elsewhere in the Arab world. Assad cracked down brutally, gunning down thousands of unarmed demonstrators. It got to the point where a lot of the soldiers ended up deserting the army, brought their guns with them, and formed a group called the Free Syrian Army, which for a time got some support from the United States. But it wasn't long before the nonviolent struggle was eclipsed by the armed struggle, and the armed struggle became dominated by these hardline Salafist Islamist groups, some of which had ties to al-Qaeda and other extremists. The U.S. never armed the Islamists directly, but the arms we gave to the more moderate secular groups often ended up in the hands of the Islamists. And since they were more powerful, in part because they were getting some support from the reactionary regimes in the Gulf region, were willing to fight under their command, as a unified front against the regime. It's very unlikely that Assad would have survived, given his lack of support. But he was rescued in large part by the Russians, which ended up in with a horrific bombing campaign in urban areas controlled by the rebels. The Hezbollah, the Shia militia in Lebanon, which had fought both Israel and fought in support of the rights of the Shia population there, in a much less popular move among the Lebanese and others, went into Syria to support Assad in suppressing the resistance. Meanwhile, Iran brought in various support, including some allied militia tied very closely to the regime there, and it pushed back the various rebel factions to only controlling a small area of up in the Idlib province, not far from Aleppo. Meanwhile, ISIS for a time took over a large part of the northeast. The Obama administration in 2016 stopped all support for the Syrian rebels for fear that if they won, the hardcore Islamists would take over, and only armed Syrians, mostly Kurds, who are willing to fight ISIS, not the Assad regime. But things have been more or less and the one group that again has had some degree of autonomy, some degree of a progressive agenda, some degree of democracy, were the autonomous Rojava Kurdish region in the northeast, which ironically got support from everybody from anarchists and other leftists who really appreciated the economic, social, and political system they'd established, but ironically also from the United States. Because, again, they were in the lead in the fight against ISIS. But in terms of Assad, people figure that he had won for all intents and purposes. But starting a little over a month ago, HTS, the largest of the armed opposition groups, again, a hardline Islamist organization, though it has moderated somewhat from its earlier incarnations as an al-Qaeda affiliate, ended up attacking some Syrian army positions in retaliation for some airstrikes that killed a number of civilians in Idlib. And much to their surprise, the Syrian army fled. And they kept advancing and ended up moving into Aleppo and taking over that major city, second largest in the country. Then they decided they'd see how far they could go. And they, within a very short period of time, they ended up marching into Damascus. And what's crucial about this is that it was not really a military victory by HTS, because there really was very little fighting. It was a political collapse of the regime. In many ways, it's very similar to what we saw in Afghanistan a few years ago, when it was clear that no matter how god-awful the Taliban was, the U.S.-backed regime of warlords and crooks and opium magnates and, you know, other nasties just did not have the support of the Afghan people. Or some of us are old enough to remember what happened in the spring of 1975 with the Thieu regime in South Vietnam. Again, it was more of a political collapse, because when you have soldiers who aren't willing to fight and die on your behalf, and your foreign support is no longer there, your days are numbered. Meanwhile, in the southern part of in the far south of Syria, where the revolution started in 2011, the workers' councils and the popular committees ended up seizing government buildings there. This is the largely nonviolent grassroots efforts that are not affiliated with the hardcore Islamists. So, you know, there's really, and they moved in Damascus in both directions. And again, the regime ended up fleeing.
Well, so you mentioned the 2011, that although I guess there's been pushback against the administration by all these various groups for a long time, but 2011 kind of sowed the seeds of that, even though the Assad regime pushed back and was violently repressive. And I guess we can talk about some of the things that have been uncovered since the fall of the regime, such as the Saydnaya prison and all the the atrocities that were committed. But there was a huge crackdown. But at the same time, there was in the regions, HTS and some of these other groups were still establishing a base in those regions from which the current actions and the ultimate defeat of the overthrow of the regime came out of that, because they had the support of a lot of the local places, right?
Yes, yes. The HTS and some allied groups, including the Turkish-backed militia that was remnants of the original U.S.-backed Free Syrian Army, they effectively ran much of that province. They were conservative. They were autocratic. They were not. They were allowed religious minorities to worship freely. They didn't insist that women cover up. They're trying to make clear that they're not simply another Taliban, and that gives some hope that the new government won't be terribly repressive. But indeed, they may recognize that in order to rebuild the country, they need to include as many people as possible, and bring back the refugees, and bring back the engineers, the doctors, the other professionals, and those that they need to rebuild this shattered society. And, you know, a lot of people are worried, and reasonably so, because of HTS's ideological, you know, foundation as an Al Qaeda affiliate extremist organization. Their leader was radicalized by the U.S. and, like many people in that part of the world, by the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and he was part of the Al Qaeda resistance against the U.S. occupation. That's how he got his start. But every Syrian that I know and my Syrian friends tend to be liberal to leftist, secular people, that they're nervous, but they are primarily relieved, indeed joyous, that Assad is overthrown. I mean, their thinking is under him, as many as 500,000 Syrians died, over 11 million people. That is over half the population, were displaced, half of whom were refugees outside the country, half of whom were internally displaced. Many of the city's great, many of the country's great cities and landmarks are in ruins. Tens of thousands of people, many tens of thousands, have been jailed and tortured. Indeed, as it appears now, at least 70,000 of those taken prisoners were tortured to death or otherwise summarily executed. And of course, the international sanctions and other problems have, you know, destroyed the economy. I mean, the country, they figure that, well, could it really be any worse? And it's, you know, possible that HTS could end up trying to impose a hardline Islamist rule, but probably no worse than some of the Gulf states that the U.S. supports, and I think certainly better than the ongoing war and suffering and brutality that the Syrians have experienced under Assad.
I want to remind listeners, this is Global Stuff. My guest is Stephen Zunis, who is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. He's the founding director of their program in Middle Eastern Studies there, an expert on the area. We're talking about Syria and the developments that have happened. As many people are aware, of the overthrow of the Assad regime that happened. He was gone from the country earlier this month, December 8th, a couple weeks ago, went to Russia, got Russia, which was a big supporter of his regime, one of the main supporters of his regime, along with Iraq and Iran. So they've given him refuge there while the country's been taken over, at least part of it. And that's what I wanted to talk about next. You've already talked about the fact that the Salafists, which is the HTS group, are a fundamentalist group, but there's openings, and we'll probably talk about that more, openings for some potential for some kind of pluralism in order for it to function. But when we've talked about Syria in the past on this program, when you look at it, and as you've already mentioned, there's a lot of factions involved in addition to HTS. And when you look at a map of the country, it doesn't seem to me that maybe HTS has taken over the main government in Damascus, but there's still large parts of the country that are held or controlled by other groups. Isn't that correct?
That's true in terms of geography. In terms of population, the vast majority of the Syrian population lives in the western quarter or third of the country, and HTS controls virtually all of that. But yes, it is still divided. There are still millions of Syrians who are out of their control, and they're really pushing to try to assert control over these remaining parts of the country. One big concern a lot of us have is as the fate of Rojava, the Kurdish-controlled areas that where they have, you know, created a good semblance of democratic self-governance. The Turkey and its allied Syrian groups are fighting to capture that, and there's been some major battles there. It's one of many situations we've run in Syria and elsewhere where you have that both sides are armed by the United States, both the Turkish government, which is a NATO member, and the Kurds, which again armed by the U.S. To fight ISIS. We also, of course, have the phenomenon of American troops that are stationed in parts of Syria, some in sort of the south central desert region near where Jordan and Iraq come together, and others more in the northeast, where some of the oil fields and some other valuable natural resources are. Of course, they were there against the will of the Syrian government under Assad. I am assuming that the HTS would like them gone too. There are some people who have argued that it's good for the United States to be there because, you know, protect the Kurds, you know, from the Turks. But the U.S. has done little to protect them from the Turks in any case. And, you know, there are questions about the legality of the U.S. troops being there. I mean, the ISIS has largely been defeated. They used to control a big swath of territory in northeastern Syria, but, you know, they're down to a few pockets of resistance, not something you could necessarily put on a map. And the U.S. has tried to justify its presence there to counter the Iranian influence and the and you know put and other for, and to try to have a more of a political presence, which really doesn't seem to be justified. I see it establishes a very dangerous precedent for the United States to say we don't. We have to have troops there to counter the political orientation of the regime because we didn't like the Russians and Iranians being there. Well, we don't have that excuse anymore. We're not protecting the Kurds. The ISIS has largely been defeated. And so it raises the question about why do we still have troops there? And indeed, there was never congressional approval for sending American troops. So it raises legal questions in terms of domestic law, not just international law. Now Trump could very well decide to remove these troops from Syria. They're in very vulnerable positions in these small forward operating bases out in the desert. But the concern there is, will he do it in such a way that will allow the Turks and their authoritarian minded leader Erdogan, who Trump likes, to come and continue its savage repression against the Kurds there.
So in effect, that's in the northeast part of the country where there's what 2,000 U.S. troops stationed there now.
Yes,
approximately.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
yeah, I mean, Trump said he was bringing the troops home from Syria when he was there before, but in fact he redeployed them from where they were protecting the Kurdish population and moved them over to the oil fields and other strategic assets that he wanted to have control over, and did nothing when the Turks came in and started slaughtering Kurdish civilians, including a prominent feminist leader and others.
Could that area be a proxy for Turkey if the U.S. does pull out against?
That's a concern. Even Kurds. Those of us who have opposed U.S. intervention in Syria, you know, do recognize that they have at times, you know, been a deterrent to Turkish aggression. But as we've done many times in history, it appears we're willing to abandon the Kurds. And generally, what a lot of us have been advocating is an idea that the U.S. would make a deal, you know, with the Turks, you know, basically saying that, okay, we're going to pull out, but you can't advance any further. And if you do, we'll cut off military aid and arms transfers and other strategic cooperation. Unfortunately, I don't think Trump has any intention of doing that.
And I wanted to go into the actions of Israel, because that's been a major factor there. According to the UK-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, that it's documented more than, and this was a while ago, so there have been many more since, more than 350 strikes by Israel since the fall of the Assad regime. And they're doing it all over the country, Damascus, Aleppo, and Hama. So what is, what's Israel's intent there, and what are their actions causing? How will that affect this transition?
Well, taking advantage of the chaos and disarray with the defeat of the regime, where the whole command and control structure had broken down, they launched this major assault, essentially destroying their navy in port, destroying airfields around the country, both military and civilian, suspected weapon depots and manufacturing centers, army bases, government buildings related to security. They basically wanted to totally destroy any capability of self-defense or anything that the Syrians might offer. And with that largely done, they ended up going beyond the area of south of western Syria they've occupied since 1967 in the Golan region, and by essentially tearing up the Kissinger's disengagement agreement that he negotiated in 1974, and moving deeper inside of Syria, including seizing Mount Hermon, the 12,000-foot peak, which is the largest in the area. Already Israelis are talking about building a ski resort there. And the U.S., even though we are a guarantor of the disengagement agreement in 1974, there's been no objections by the Biden administration about Israeli aggression. And it sends us several messages that the new government's going to have to consider. One is that the West, particularly the United States, is willing to see their assets, strategic and otherwise, destroyed, more of their land taken, and this could very well drive them back to a more hardline policy, both domestically and foreign. And the other thing, of course, is that the United States is the only country in the world that has formally recognized Israel's illegal annexation of the Golan, which it did in 1981. In response, the United Nations Security Council unanimously condemned the move and said the annexation is null and void, based on the concept that no country can expand its territory by force. No country can unilaterally change its international boundaries. That's the justification we've been using for supporting Ukraine all this time. But the Biden administration argues that no, in the case of an ally, when they invade and occupy and annex and expand their territory by force, it's okay. And this is amazing because even Reagan supported the resolution calling it null and void. But Biden is essentially saying Reagan's too liberal and too attached to international law, and that what Israel's done is right. And it's amazing. If you look at any world map, Rand McNally, National Geographic, Google, Apple, the Golan is seen either as part of Syria or with hash marks or a dotted line or something right. Showing its special status. But in the in U.S. government maps, it's all part of Israel. And indeed, the Russians ended up citing the U.S. recognition of Israel's annexation of the Golan at a United Nations debate over Ukraine. To make the case that the United States really wasn't about upholding a rules-based international order, because they were quite willing to support the very kind of land grabs and aggression that the Russians have been involved in.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
Again, I want to remind the listeners, this is Global Stuff. My name is Jimmy Derschlag, my guest for this show, bringing him back on to discuss a very current situation happening in the Middle East, the transition, the overthrow of the Assad regime in Syria, the transition to a new government, and all the forces that are at play there. Stephen Zunis, the professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, so glad that he's with us today. I'm sure acclimated, but it's 6 months since you've been back from your visiting professorship in Sweden. So that was a great honor that you had. I'm sure you appreciated that.
And there's also an example of just how isolated the United States is in the world on Middle East policy. The UN Security Council resolutions we have vetoed as the only negative vote, and otherwise unanimous resolutions, being one of only less than 10 countries in the 193-member UN General Assembly to vote against these broad-based resolutions upholding international law and human rights. The others voting no were pretty much exclusively, you know, far right-wing governments like Hungary and Argentina, or these economically dependent tiny Pacific Island states. It's really a pretty. I mean, Israel has announced it's doubling its settlements in the occupied Golan. These are clear violations of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibit any country from moving civilians onto territories seized by military force. But in the Biden administration's view, it's not occupied territory anymore. It is now part of Israel, so it is therefore okay. And again, it's just stunning that the what an outlier the United States is internationally in terms of some of the most basic principles of international law. Like, you can't just invade other countries and colonize them.
Let me, this is a call-in show, and this is a good time to open up the lines. And it looks like there's already somebody calling in. We'll give Michael a chance to get that caller on the air, and we'll see what they want to talk about. So I guess they're ready to go. Hi, welcome to the show.
So again, you can't thank enough this opportunity with KMUD and the Free Speech Radio. Speech is threatened. Knowledge is threatened. We live in a moment where fact is suspect. We have less than a calendar month for a very threatening change in our overall governance. You know, it's interesting. I have to recognize that individual one speaks to fragments of truth from time to time about the overreach of the state. But we're looking at a moment historically where the Constitution has been violated by allowing an insurrectionist to achieve the state of presidency again. It's a clear violation of law. And again, thank you to KMUD News for having a constitutional professor espouse upon that tonight on our free speech radio waves.
All right.
My point would be this. When we're talking about these numbers of, Azerbaijan, are they going to react because the Russians shot down a civilian airplane? The casualty of war, the AI assassination of children, wiping out lineage in Palestine. We're looking at the study of war. So my question of you as a study professor is, are we really looking at the fact that the monetization behind militarization overwhelms even the corporation of democracy, that it's so overwhelming, these money whores, would continue to threaten our peace on a declining environmental planet? War is a huge environmental disaster, not just a humanitarian disaster.
The Pentagon is the world's number one.
For goodness sake, thanks for being a rational mind. And folks, if you're listening, support this free speech radio. It's all we got.
All right. Well, let's let Professor Zunis talk.
It's a good point. Certainly, the Pentagon is the world's number one carbon emitter, and it's really hard to believe that when occasionally some good climate related legislation comes through, that the same members of Congress, you know, support for an $865 billion Pentagon budget. That doesn't even count the nuclear side of the military, which is under the Energy Department, or does it count the CIA and its huge, huge budget, which is a secret. And that, the C-130 cargo planes to take our troops and our tanks to the Middle East and elsewhere. I mean, it's you know, it dumps more carbon into the atmosphere than any of us could imagine using in our entire lifetimes. And so, and this is not really talked about. And I think the fact that we do have such, and the fact that one of the reasons that Democrats have been losing white working class voters is that Trump disingenuously has talked about bringing the troops home, of not getting involved in these foreign affairs, and disingenuously said that he opposed the Iraq war when he actually supported it. But, you know, that was used against Clinton. It was used against Biden. It was used against Schumer. A lot of, you know, Democrats who support the invasion of Iraq, which is what created ISIS and a lot of the problems that were now being used as an excuse to send even more troops to the region. And because it's the sons and daughters of these working class people who are sent off. And I remember when Trump announced he was pulling troops away from Syria, he said, "I'm bringing the troops home." This was at a rally in Texas, and people started chanting, "Bring the troops home, bring the troops home, bring the troops home." And I thought, wow, a Republican rally in Texas, you know? Right. And this is an example, I think, that how there's been a big shift in, you know, people not wanting the U.S. to be spending all this money in these lives, and as the caller pointed out, the damage it's doing to the global environment, and neither party has been able to really tackle this kind of the importance that we have other priorities. The big threat is not ISIS, it's not these governments that fail to abide by U.S. hegemonic priorities. The biggest threat is indeed the climate, and so the this is all comes down. And this is why when I talk about things in the Middle East, I really even when I talk about Israel and Palestine, I think the talk about AIPAC and the Israel lobby is grossly exaggerated, frankly, because what we're doing in the Middle East is the same thing we did in Central America, in Southeast Asia, in Southern Africa, and elsewhere, in our support for far right wing regimes that have engaged in genocide and other forms of repression. We support tyrants in the Middle East the same reason we support tyrants in Latin America and elsewhere. That the problem is much bigger than a single lobby. The problem is the whole military-industrial complex, and the overly militarized focus of our foreign policy.
Again, we're speaking with Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. You can call in 707-923-3911. Probably that number's ingrained in the brains of many people after our membership drives and all the other times you've heard it. So we do appreciate that caller's comments. Going on with the we were talking about Israel, Trump has said that it's not our fight when he was asked about Syria, but we know how much he considers Bibi, Netanyahu, his buddy, and how supportive Biden and his administration and most American administrations have been of Israel. I was reading an article in Al Jazeera about a part of you would know where that is, Kenetra,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Kenetra, yeah. In Syria.
Yeah, I've been there actually. Yeah,
where there's basically Israel is control, has its checkpoints in that Syria village and controlling, destroying homes there and controlling that region.
Kenetra was the capital. It's actually bigger than a village. It was the capital of the Kenetra province, which is of clearly the Golan, and Israel initially seized it in the 1967 war, and part of Kissinger's disengagement agreement, they would agree to withdraw slightly, including giving Syrians Kenetra back, but they ended up physically destroying almost the entire town. The Syrians haven't rebuilt it because much of it was a big agricultural center, and the farmlands and on three sides are under Israeli occupation. But also, frankly, it's a propaganda tool to take visitors such as me. I was in a delegation there back in the 90s, led by John B. Anderson, the former a moderate Republican congressman from Illinois who had run for president in 1980. But they have now, some people definitely live there. Now the Israelis have taken it again. And is basically treating it like occupied territory, like in the West Bank, where you have to go through checkpoints to go anywhere.
Let me jump in because we do have some callers, and I want to give them some time. So I hope the callers will hang in there. Hi, welcome to the show. You're on the air.
I would love to hear your guest Stephen's opinion about in recent memory. When Netanyahu spoke before the Senate and Congress, Harris and Biden refused to be there. I mean, they made a statement at that point that pretty much spoke against Netanyahu and his visit. And then what the hell happened there? How have we gotten to where we are at this point in terms of within Biden's last month now and this whole year of Gaza to have been in this position of being the primary supporters of this war and of the weapons and can you please explain that? And
Biden's been the primary supporter from the get-go. He's had some specific disagreements with Netanyahu on some things. He didn't like the way the House Republican leadership was using Netanyahu's visit for political advantage. But there's no shift. And Biden is always one of the biggest hawks when it came to the Middle East as in the Senate. He, as head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he pushed through the Iraq war opposition, didn't allow people opposed to the war to testify, and basically was totally in league with the Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld. And on Israel, he's also always been a big, big hawk. And so his attacks against the International Criminal Court, his attacks against the International Court of Justice, his attacks against Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, he really is extreme and very much an outlier in the international community. I mean, just a few weeks ago, he welcomed Yoav Gallant, the former Israeli defense minister, to the White House. He is an indicted war criminal. He's been indicted by the ICC for war crimes, including crimes against humanity, along with Netanyahu. And 124 countries would have arrested him if he'd gone, but Biden welcomes him. I mean, I think we're going to look back at Biden the way we look back at Lyndon Johnson, that he had a surprisingly progressive domestic record and did some good things, but his legacy is going to be him supporting a genocidal war, as we think of Lyndon Johnson in the case of Vietnam.
Well, she was asking how we got here, but as you're saying, it's been very consistent.
Here because, Democratic Party establishment isn't listening to its people. Right. They basically take the line that, what are you going to do, vote Republican? We'll do what we want here. I mean, 80% of Democrats want a ceasefire. The vast majority of Democrats want the 80% of Democrats want the U.S. to condition military aid to Israel. Vast majority of Democrats want the U.S. to recognize Palestine along with Israel. These are all policies that the Biden has rejected, as have the Democratic leaders in Congress, Schumer in the Senate and Jeffries in the House. And so we have Nancy Pelosi insisting that anti-war protesters are agents of Russia and China. I mean, it's ridiculous. We only got 19 senators to support a very modest effort to withhold certain specific kinds of weapons that were being used in major atrocities against civilian population centers. The Democratic leadership is more out of touch with its constituents on this than any other issue. And by this, I don't just mean Israel. You could say the same thing about support for Saudi Arabia and some of the Arab dictatorships. That's why you have so many protests and the militancy we've been seeing on a lot of college campuses and elsewhere, that our elected representatives do not represent us. And despite warnings, Harris did not distance herself much from, if at all, from Biden's policies, alienating Arab Americans, young people, Muslims, progressive voters. At least some of the, it could have made the, in fact, it could have even indeed made the difference in the election, since it was very close in a number of swing states. And we are really in a crisis. This is a crisis of democracy in many respects, when you have a government that is so out of touch with the American people. And of course, it's only going to get much, much worse.
Right.
Trump.
Well, we do have another caller who'd been patiently waiting. Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for hanging in there. You are now on the air. Welcome to the show.
So are they using, is Israel using depleted uranium around Gaza and to the north? And what's the status on depleted uranium in the Middle East these days?
Well, depleted uranium is usually used to penetrate heavy armored vehicles. And the targets for Israel are buildings and tents, and they don't need depleted uranium to do their damage. They're willing to drop these huge bombs and these missiles, all conveniently supplied by the most of them supplied by the American taxpayer, to go after various buildings and, again, largely civilian targets. So I don't think a DU is an issue in the current fighting.
One of the things I noticed is that the way the rebels, HTS and others, were able to scope out what was happening was by the use of drones. I was thinking, well, where did they get those? Are those through channels that alter?
Yeah, there's a huge black market for arms, and even drone technology is getting simpler and easier to procure. The fact that they captured a lot of weapons, from the Syrians, they've captured some weapons that were given to other moderate groups by the U.S. and others. And they have some friends in the Gulf who've supplied them more directly, usually with U.S.-made equipment. So, again, U.S. hasn't directly armed the Islamists, but, again, most of their equipment is of U.S.-made.
One of the things that was predicted, of course, there was in the initial euphoric aftermath of the fall of the regime, is how many of the people, well, not only the freeing of the prisoners in prisons there, but also the Sednaya and other prisons, but also the exiles coming back.
There
have been like 30,000 or more of them.
Well, there are 6 million exiles, and tens of thousands are starting to come back. The terror and repression, particularly by the regime, but also some rebel factions, did lead to this massive exodus. It's really striking because there are some people in the anti-imperialist left, and I don't use that as a derogatory term. I consider myself part of the anti-imperialist left, but there are some elements that have actually, because we are lied to about Iraq, because we've been lied to about Israel and Palestine, and lied to about a lot of things, there are some people who were doubting the reports of the use of chemical weapons and other atrocities by the Assad regime. In this case, though, they were indeed mostly true. Indeed, there's a remarkable parallel in many ways between those rationalizing for Assad's war crimes and those for Israeli war crimes. They insist Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and the UN are biased. They insist that all the media coverage is biased. They insist, They insist it's all for self-defense, that even rescue workers are actually terrorists. I mean, it is quite striking, the rationalizations for both Israeli and, war crimes and the Syrian government's war crimes really parallel each other. But I think we need to be really, and the thing about the Syrians right now, you know, I get a lot of questions in these interviews about what does it mean in terms of Iran's role and Russian's role and in the geopolitical context, what it means for Israel, this and that and the other. But the fact is the Syrian people don't give a damn really what it means on a geopolitical level. They just want to be freed from a hated regime. And I think we really need to give agency to the people of Syria. This is not, you know, I've written books and I've spent my career critiquing U.S. intervention and what its damage has done. But the Syrians would have won anyway. The Assad would have been overthrown regardless of anything the United States did, regardless of what Israel did. When a regime doesn't have support of the people, it can no longer stay in power.
And that's your quote that's getting a little bit of internet circulation there. The regime doesn't have the support of the people, it ultimately will fail. It rests on the willingness of the people to obey it. We do have another call.
I was in Afghanistan many years ago during the Tsar Revolution when Mohammed Daoud was overthrown. And I have to say the Afghanis were very, very considerate, Pashtun Wali and all, to get me out of there safely. I was by myself. But I've had a fascination for the country ever since. And back to your points about the international arms market, what happened to all that stuff we left there?
Oh, it's in the hands of the Taliban. Just like all the stuff we gave the Shah, you know, got in the hands of the Islamic Republic. And everything we gave the Tea regime in the hands of the communists. I mean, I mean, even most of ISIS's weapons are of U.S. manufacture that they're able to, you know, seize from Iraqi government positions and places like that. I mean, that's really the one of the crazy things about the arms sales, arms transfers, arms exports is that you know, they very often get into the hands of the very forces that the United States opposes, and then that's used as justification for manufacturing more arms to fight them.
So we don't have a lot of time left. Again, Stephen Zunis, my guest, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. One of the interesting things about that situation right now with the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham having overthrown the regime, and now, as I saw today, there in another article from Al Jazeera from the last couple of days, is there's now the different factions have agreed to unite under the Ministry of Defense that has been set up. So there's some unification of all these different groups that have been fighting in the country for so long. So there seems to be some unification going on among those various elements. But also, it's different from some situations in that Russia, China, the U.S., even the U.N., and Iraq and Iran, who were kind of Russia was supporting, none of those are controlling the factions that are now in power in that country. So it seems like they're somewhat uniquely independent, considering how the major powers try to influence what's going on in these conflict regions around the world.
Yes, we've seen in Lebanon and Syria and Iraq in terms of their civil wars, that all sorts of outside powers would try to get in on the action, try to influence the outcome, try to support their favorite factions. But of course, that just ended up in getting a lot more people killed. But I really think that for Syrians right now, their priority, and this is both for the HTS and ordinary Syrians, is to try to rebuild their savage country, that they really need to focus on rebuilding, on repatriation, on unification. And they really do not want to be distracted by the geopolitics. They're obviously going to want some foreign aid, and unfortunately, often foreign aid just comes with strings attached, whether it be from the Gulf or from the West or from anywhere else. I think that the key is rebuilding that rebuilding the country, and the level of devastation of which is just hard to imagine.
And what do you think their prospects are? Do you think they have a chance of actually promoting some pluralism and not getting wrapped up in the fundamentalist aspects? Yeah.
I don't trust HTS, frankly. You know, I think if they could impose a very hardline, a fundamentalist kind of theocracy, that they would. But I think they also recognize that, they need the help of all sorts of Syrians. They need the help of the international community. They do need, if for pragmatic reasons, if not for political reasons, they really need to diversify and have at least some degree of pluralism. I don't really trust them that much. I mean, they can also use the excuse, oh, things are so bad, we have to be tough, and we have to be dictatorial and everything. But the very fact that this revolution was initially a civilian-based one, was initially a popular pro-democracy struggle, that I think there is pressure from below as well. That it's just as I noted that Assad's collapse ultimately was because people wouldn't obey him and people didn't recognize his authority. The new government has to deal with that as well. And I was very impressed with how civil society was able to mobilize during the first 9 or 10 months of revolution, and it was mostly democratic and it was mostly nonviolent. Now, a lot of these people are dead or in exile, but there are still enough people around that, especially in places like Daraa and other areas in the south, that they are rebuilding these popular democratic grassroots institutions, and could certainly could conceivably be a check on any and on at least some of the authoritarian impulses of the new Syrian leadership.
Well, thanks so much, Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. We really appreciate you making the time to come on the show in this holiday season and share your thoughts. We appreciate the callers and their thoughts as well. I'm sure we'll have you back on. There's always situations that deserve your expertise. Happy New Year to everyone. Thanks to Michael McCaskill for engineering. This has been Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.